Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Gravity had a good run, but it's time to feel the weightlessness of the Brooks Glycerin 21. These running shoes feature nitrogen-infused DNA Loft V3 cushioning. Brooks has even magnified the plushness to elevate the softness to new levels. And if you want extra support, find these same features in the Brooks Glycerin GTS 21. Learn more and shop now at brooksrunning.com. That's brooksrunning.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lois Lowry is the author of The Giver, the dystopian young adult novel from 1993 that's become a staple of middle school reading lists all over. In The Giver, she explored a society where there is no conflict, no questioning, no uncertainty, no love. The book became a trilogy. Now Lowry's out with a fourth and last installment, Son, where she explores what happened to the characters in The Giver. This hour on Point, Lois Lowry on life, freedom, young readers, and her new book, concluding the Giver series, Son. Later in the hour, we'll talk to Time Magazine's Lev Grossman about J.K. Rowling's new book, The Casual Vacancy, her first since Harry Potter. You can join the conversation this hour. Did you read Lois Lowry's The Giver? What's your question for the writer? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Lois Lowry, two-time winner of the Newbery Medal, author of the Giver series, author of Number the Stars, and many more. She's also written the Anastasia, Sam Tate's, and Goonie Bird series. Out next week, the fourth and last in the Giver series, Son, S-O-N. Lois Lowry, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for spelling the title, because, of course, it could be read or heard differently.
Any which way, but, of course, it's Son, and that's very important in this story, because for readers of The Giver, this is all connected, and it starts right off with the birth of a child who readers of The Giver will know well from many years ago.
That's true, but they won't recognize him right away. Mm-hmm. When I was writing this book, or when I was starting to write it, it was because so many readers had asked about the baby who appears at the end of The Giver. Who appears throughout The Giver, but at the end, he's there in the final scene, and then he's not mentioned really in the following two books. And readers had asked me so often about him. So I sat down to write about him, and then my attention was diverted when I thought about his origins. In the book The Giver, there had been a category of young girls, age 12, selected for their future job, which was to give birth to babies who would form the next generation in the community. And I began to wonder about what girl would have been selected to give birth to this child. And so she's the one giving birth on page one, and she's the center character of this new book.
And off the story goes, weaving a different thread through the fabric of the Giver universe that you created now, what, more than 20 years ago?
Hard to believe it's been that long.
It really is. We'll have generations, almost, at this point, of readers of The Giver. But we'll also have some that didn't. Remind us of the community that you described in that book, the kind of cornerstone of this trilogy, now four-part. Just describe that community, for that dystopian community.
Yeah, when I began to write The Giver, I was focusing on the concept of human memory, which had always fascinated me. And my father was old then, beginning to lose his memory. And so I began to think about a group of people, later I called them a community, who had found a way to manipulate and control human memory. Once I realized that that had to be in the future, I found myself writing a book I had never intended to write, which was a futuristic novel. And I created the community in which these people lived in some unnamed future time. And I looked out my window. I lived at the time on Beacon Hill.
In Boston, yes.
And I looked out my window and I saw all the things that troubled my own life. I saw poverty on the streets. I saw cars, pollution, crime, all the things that make our lives difficult. And I did away with them all. So I created
in this
imaginary future place. And I tried to seduce the reader, the young reader, into thinking what a wonderful place this would be. And then I very gradually introduced the compromises that the people governing the community would have made in order to create such a safe and comfortable place.
And why was the manipulation and obliteration, in many ways, of memory a key to creating that smooth, ordered, dystopian community?
Well, let me point out also that in this smooth, ordered community, there's no literature and there's no art and there's no music.
And there's no love.
That's true. And the reason that it lacks those things, literature, art, and music, is because there's no love and because there's no strong emotion. And so out of that suppression of emotion has arisen a place that's very comfortable, but it's lacking the things that make life bearable. And in order to create that community, they had to do away with the memory of anything troubling. And so the people there have no memory of crime, pollution, war, poverty, mm-hmm. all of the things that I did away with. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes them able to live in this oddly sterile and emotionless world.
But what one thing they do have assigned pretty early on, kind of whether they like it or not, they have jobs. I mean, they have
yes.
tasks.
Yes, there's no unemployment in a world like this.
And I found myself wondering about this generation who's all read, maybe in middle school, The Giver, and thought, oh, no, that would be terrible. And now here they are out of college, back in the parents' basement, no and job, and thinking, well, I might take a little sterility for a job.
Exactly. The concept of employment in the world of The Giver is interesting. Kids are selected after being carefully watched and monitored at age 12 and told what they're going to be in the future. And often when the book is used in schools, teachers will hold a fake ceremony and assign kids their future jobs. Mm-hmm. And also they're assigned their spouses. And you know, they're
in the community.
In the community, mm-hmm. yes. There is an element of that which is appealing. If you're assigned a spouse who is carefully selected for you, I would have liked being able to do that for my own kids on occasion, or a job for which you're qualified and which you will love, rather than to go out into this world today and make your own choices, which very often are disastrous, or perhaps there isn't a choice there in terms of a job.
No job to be had.
That's right. So the world of The Giver is in many ways a very appealing place.
Has it made you rethink your attitude toward it at all?
Toward
well, the chaos and unemployment versus the order
sure.
the job.
There are things that I would love to have be as they are in that world. But, of course, the sacrifices you make to achieve that are too huge.
Lois Lowry is with us. She's author of The Giver, the books that followed, many different series. And now the last in The Giver series, Son. It comes out, next week?
I believe the 2nd, which is next Tuesday.
We've got callers coming in Somerset, Kentucky. Shella, you're on the air with Lois Lowry. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lois.
Hi.
I just wanted to say thank you for your book. I've read The Giver every year since it came out, and I'm going to be 30 this year. I read Messenger and Gathering Blue, and I'm very excited about the fourth installment to this series. It's just, The Giver was just such a pivotal book for my childhood and my adolescence and even my adulthood. Every winter I pull it out. So.
Why do you keep reading it again and again and again there in Somerset, Kentucky?
Do you find new things in it each time?
Yeah, every time I find a new way to relate to it. When I was younger, I was always very related to Asher. You know, I felt like, you know, I couldn't really get things right. I didn't really feel like I was fitting the mold. And, you know, I find more and more significance to it as the years go by.
Oh, thank you. I hope you're going to love the new book, which is going to include Jonas as an adult. Unfortunately, Asher has disappeared. We don't know what became of him. But Gabe is the focus of the new book, the baby. He's now 14 years old.
And the young birth mother who takes off on an epic journey to find him. Shella, thanks very much for your call. Lois, I mean, you bring back, in the original, you've got The Giver who does have a memory, a keeper of memories.
Yeah.
Old guy, I guess, on the cover that many people have seen over the years. And he's passing it on to this young Jonas. Now, Jonas shows up in this book as well.
Jonas is now an adult. He's married. He has children. But it's really Gabriel who's the focus of the book. And then, of course, Gabriel's mother, who is a new character, somebody who appeared in my awareness. And she's the center of the first two-thirds of the book as she searches for this child who has been taken away from her twice, once when she gives birth to him.
Blindfolded, so that in their system, these young mothers don't even create an attachment to their newborn babies.
And so he's gone, but she finds a way to keep track of him in the community and to know where he is throughout his first year. And then when the boy Jonas flees with the baby, she's lost him for a second time.
What's the theme, the thematic evolution here? We kind of get the theme of the giver. Where do you go with it?
Oh, gosh. I think the theme, there are probably several themes, and I know teachers will find all sorts of other political and religious themes as well. But to me, it focuses on the bond between a parent and child. Most books for young adults now, I think, focus rightly on a child separating from parents, becoming independent. And so it's rare to find one for a kid that age, about a kid that age, which is about the bond between the parent and child. So it focuses on that. And it also focuses on sacrifice. What would you be willing to give up in order to achieve blank? In this case, what would the young woman, Claire, be willing to sacrifice in order to find her son? And I won't ruin the plot of the book by divulging what that is, but it's an important question.
You laid out some skepticism about sacrifice, I would say, in The Giver, in a way, because people had given up so much passion, love, in order to have constancy.
Yes, and when kids ask me, as they often do because they're writing a paper for school,
right.
I get emails every day. I answered some this morning.
Yeah.
What is the theme of The Giver? I tell them the thing to take away from The Giver is the importance of the choices we make. And, of course, this final book, and thank you for using the word last. I once stupidly said The Giver would not have sequels, and, of course, it has now.
Yeah, okay.
But this is the last and final one, and it closes the circle, as it were. And now I've forgotten where I was going with that statement, but the theme of the final book has to do also with choices and sacrifice and what Claire sacrifices for her son.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with celebrated children's writer, young adult writer Lois Lowry, author of the young adult now classic, The Giver. Her latest and last, she says, in that series, Sun, is out next week, and she is with us in the studio today. A little later in this hour, we'll check in on J.K. Rowling's latest after Harry Potter. But Lois Lowry here right now. Lois, I want to play just a little bit for you of another young adult series that's gotten so much attention. I wonder if it's influenced the way you're writing these days. Here's just a little bit from the film version of The Hunger Games released earlier this year, video played for prospective candidates here of the games, explaining how 13 districts that rebelled against the country that fed them were defeated.
When the traitors were defeated, we swore as a nation we would never know this treason again. And so it was decreed that each year the various districts of Pan Am would offer up in tribute one young man and woman to fight to the death in a pageant of honor, courage, and sacrifice.
Fighting to the death in the Hunger Games. And Lois, I just asked myself, and here's another big series that's arisen since you came out with The Giver, and it has so much action. It's got bows and arrows and running through the woods and all the rest, and I wonder if it's influenced you as a young adult fiction writer in the way you present your tale.
Oh, gosh, I'm not sure that it has. I did read The Hunger Games. I haven't seen the movie, but you're certainly correct that there's a whole lot of action in it and fighting and killing and all of those things that kids love to read about and apparently to see in the movies. I think one of the reasons that The Giver has been out in Hollywood now for a long time, and although the movie is supposed to be in the works, it has taken them 16 years, and that's probably because there's not a lot of action in it. It's an introspective book. Mm-hmm. If they ever get around to making the sequel or the fourth book, Sun, they will find more action in that.
You've got a lot of cliff climbing here.
Yes,
and action and things that a camera could go to town on. Did that come naturally to you? Did you sort of poke yourself and say, hey, Lois, let's get some more action scenes in here for Hollywood or for changing tastes in young readers or just for your own?
I'm not sure I was consciously thinking Hollywood or even of young readers. I tend to stay more to myself. Mm-hmm. But what I had to do in this fourth book is to cover 14 years. And so you can't do that in a slow-paced, introspective way. You have to have things happen. And so there is this action-packed middle section in which the young girl seeking her boy, whom she's lost, finds herself in immense danger.
Remind us of who's at the top of that cliff and what that presents.
Okay. In the third book, Messenger, there's a new character introduced who's kind of sinister and mysterious, and his name is Trademaster. Mm-hmm. In that third book, he sort of appears in various communities, maybe once a year, and there's not a celebration, but an event takes place, and he offers people trades. They can trade for something, and they have to sacrifice something.
What kind of trades?
Well, in that fourth book, there's a character. He's the schoolmaster, actually, and he's an older man, widowed, and he's disfigured by a birthmark. And he trades away a certain amount of his humanity and his empathy in order to be young and attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And at any rate, Trademaster, who is sort of left there in the fourth book as a mystery, reappears late in the fourth book, Son, and he's the one who offers Claire, the birth mother, a trade, that he will provide for her access to her son, but she has to sacrifice something. And I won't ruin the plot by telling readers what it is that she sacrifices, but I think it's an indicator of something the book is about, of what you would be willing to give up for somebody you love.
Do we all make trades like this in our lives? It can sound like a deal with the devil, and yet there are trade-offs in every life.
Well, there are trades and trades, but sure we do. And unfortunately, I think a lot of today's youngsters are very into commercialism, and that's one of the things that is dealt with in Trademaster's role in the third book, not so much in the fourth. But people in the book want a thing. I think in one case it's a sewing machine. In another case it's a gaming machine, like
jazzy,
a slot
shiny
machine.
Stuff.
Shiny
yeah.
stuff. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I have grandchildren, and I see them going for the shiny stuff, too. And perhaps I would have when I was
What
a
are
kid.
They giving up to get it?
What are they giving up to get it is the question, yeah.
What's the answer,
a wise one?
A
book is supposed to raise questions, not necessarily to answer them, because I would like readers to think about what their own answers are, rather than to try to spell it all out for them.
There's so much in this book of a mother yearning for the child that she hasn't known in the years since The Giver. Sadly, tragically, you knew that experience personally. After The Giver came out, you lost one of your own
sons. One of my own sons killed in a plane crash.
An Air Force pilot.
Yes, yes. It was a military tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what it's like to have lost a son. But, you know, horrible as that was for me and my family, mm-hmm. I think it would not be as awful as losing a son and knowing he's out there somewhere and not knowing where he is.
Mm-hmm.
I have sometimes referred to an event that happened back in the 70s when I lived in Maine as the mother of four kids at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was Labor Day weekend. A family was camping in a campground in northern Maine, and their four-year-old boy wandered off. And I watched in the newspapers as searchers went out, first small groups and then helicopters and dogs and state police. And they never, ever found a trace of that child. I remember thinking, how could those parents pack up their car and go home?
Drive home without the child in the back seat.
It would have been easier, horrible though it would be, to have that child drown or die in an accident,
yeah.
as my son did,
yeah.
and at least to know, because not knowing is the unspeakably horrible part. And that's what happens to Claire in the book. She doesn't know what has happened to her son.
Lois Lowry, who's written and lived with everything that can mean in the years since The Giver, Sun is out now. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York. Victor's calling. Hi, Victor. You're on the air with Lois Lowry.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just wanted to say, when you said The Giver as the title for today, we've been talking, I remember distinctly when I was in fifth grade having our teacher start the book for us and then have us finish it. And I can tell you I was so intrigued and it was so easy to visualize the story that it actually started off my desire to read as a young adult.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear that.
I can still tell you every bit of the story. I remember it like I read it yesterday. And what's intriguing the most to me is I have a son who's just about the same age now, where I'll be reading it to him very shortly.
Oh, that's terrific.
That's great. What did it tell you about life and the world, or what does it, Victor?
Well, to me, it shows that you can't take things at face value. You have to let it mean something to you. And that was the real discovery of the story, was that what was important? Where would you find your own meaning? Would you make it, or would you let other people tell you what should define who you are?
And Victor, was that a discussion that your teacher initiated, or at fifth grade age, did you come up with that yourself, or have you thought about it since and come up with it?
I was not a passionate student at that age. So for me to find something that captured my attention and really let me discover something about who I was, it motivated me. And I can tell you I've read hundreds of novels since that point in my life, all looking for that kind of story that touched me ever since. So it was more of a personal development that came from the story.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
That's terrific, Victor. We wish you a very, significant interaction with your own son around the book as you wade into it. And thanks so much for calling from Buffalo. Let me get one more, if I may. Sarah in Framingham, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on with Lois Lowry.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lois.
Hi
there.
First of all, Tom, I just want to mention I'm a huge fan of yours. I've been listening to you since I was a little kid, and I was commuting back and forth to school.
Yeah, wow.
Reading Lois Lowry's works, and couldn't even understand everything, but then slowly came to realize that I absolutely loved the show.
Oh, that's
very now
kind.
I stream it.
You're very kind.
On, online, and a big fan.
What about The Giver, Sarah?
on to The Giver. I just wanted to say thank you so much to Lois Lowry for bringing The Giver into my life as a child. I read it as a young kid, I think also fifth grade. I guess that seems pretty standard. Mm-hmm. Although by the time we had gotten to it in school, I had a bunch of older siblings, and they had already read it when they were in fifth grade, and I had already picked it up at that point. So I said, oh, I read that book, and I love it. And, and I've been rereading it probably almost every year.
Wow.
What does it say to you, Sarah? What's the message?
Well, it brought so many interesting questions to me, to my, mm-hmm. my childhood existence. There was, repression of so many feelings and sexual repression as well, mm-hmm. that was going on. And I was growing up in a religious school, in an Orthodox school. So we, were taught in many ways to repress different things. And so I found it so interesting to be reading this, most of my class also being religious, and starting to think about, is that a good thing, to repress this, mm-hmm. and to repress that,
mm-hmm.
even though the purpose, the higher purpose might be good. Is it good to repress these things?
Did your teachers discuss this with you in school?
A little bit. Definitely. They brought it up. It's hard to remember everything, in grade school, but definitely we had, class discussions. And I thought about it, on my own, introspectively. Repression and free will,
mm-hmm.
because that's another thing that I kept thinking about. It's just so hard for anyone to grasp, is the concept of free will,
Sarah, do you think in your own life it has prompted you to live more consciously, to lean toward freedom, toward exercising free will, or not?
I think so. Yeah, I think that it probably opened up a door to me to start thinking about these things, and that door never really closed.
Well, that's what a book should do, I think, whether it's The Giver or the books that follow it or books by other authors or The Hunger Games. The fact that it opens a door for a kid is an important thing.
Sarah, I really appreciate your call and your listening so much, and I appreciate your saying so. Not everybody was delighted with you opening up some of these doors, talking about sexual repression, stirrings, and all the rest. You've had pushback over the years. Has that diminished? I mean, dystopian novels for young adults were not at all common when this came out. I guess there'd been Lord of the Flies, but, you know, in a way, you broke open a big chapter of dystopian.
Yeah, people refer to The Giver as the first dystopian novel for young readers. Lord of the Flies preceded it, but it was published as an adult book. And, of course, nowadays, every other book you pick up for young people is a dystopian novel. It's interesting to see that progression. The Giver, however, in addition to being lauded in various ways and winning the Newbery Medal and other awards, was also for many years one of the most challenged books in the United States.
That challenged in the sense of literally get it out of the classroom, out of the library?
It means a parent has objected to it and requested that it be removed. Usually when a book is challenged, it goes through a legal procedure. And in most cases, with The Giver, it has been returned to the classroom. It's very seldom been censored and removed. But that
what
has
were the grounds for the challenge typically?
Well, most often they refer, a parent who objects to the book refers to one of two passages. One is the fact that the kid reports, as he's required to in the book, a dream that he had to his parents. And it's a vaguely sexual dream. Mm-hmm. And so the parents realize it is time to give him the pills that repress any sexual feelings. Mm-hmm. And it's referred to in the book as the stirrings. Mm-hmm. It's something that all kids are familiar with by that age and that they've been taught about by their parents or in school. But having it mentioned in a book was troubling to some parents. Mm-hmm. The other section that they refer to is where the father, who as part of his job is required to kill a newborn baby. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's a very troubling scene. But it's frequently, by people who object to the book, taken out of context because what it is intended to portray is the depth to which the society has sunk in its repression of feelings. So it's certainly not promoting euthanasia as it has been accused of.
As more and more dystopian novels have come out, young adult books, have objections to The Giver diminished? Are parents now accustomed to this kind of material in young classrooms, younger?
I think it's true that I haven't read the current crop of dystopian books, but they do tend to have more violence than The Giver does. I don't hear of objections to that, interestingly. And I know my own grandsons, who are now 11 and 14, I've gone with them to movies, and there are scenes where I have to cover my eyes, but they don't. They're inured to violence.
What do you think about the proliferation of, it's almost the standard now that young adult work is dystopian. I mean, can the scales get tipped too far in that direction? You know, need more Wind in the Willows and Lassie and less, I don't know, Hunger Games?
I don't
Games
think we'll ever go back to Lassie, unfortunately, because it would be very appealing to me. But here is my guess. When I was a kid growing up, it was during World War II. I'm in my 70s. I'm 75. So I was growing up in the early 40s. My father was off at the war. I was aware at the war, but I was not bombarded with images. We had no television. Mm-hmm. I didn't see the war taking place. Nowadays, kids are aware every minute of the violence around the world and the threat to us from around the world. So I think they're concerned about the future in a way that I was not as a child. I think I assumed the war would end as it did, life would be okay as it was for a while. Mm-hmm. But nowadays kids are uncertain and they're frightened.
Does that mean if you don't have a pretty significant dystopian streak, they're just not going to take it seriously? It won't line up with their comprehension of the world?
Well, I think what they want to do, kids reading these books, what they're interested in is, and it's often called speculative fiction, speculating what is the world going to be like in the future. And, of course, none of us know that. And so there are these various things presented, The Giver being one, and the current crop of dystopian books. Are simply put out there as this is what it could become. And I think it empowers kids in a way to see themselves as a way of affecting the future.
Is there a point at which it can become exploitive?
Oh,
Ooga booga.
Of course, it already is. Movies are exploitive. You know, publishers want to make money, as they should. Mm-hmm. And if publishers don't make money, authors can't make a living. Movies want to make money. And so sometimes it goes too far.
And yet, kids know the world, they know these days, and see the world is tough and rough. They want to try and figure it out. and they're going to grab on to these stories and maybe find some, I don't know, path through all their
some
perceptions.
Hope, some
maybe yeah. hope. Maybe yeah. maybe they work for it themselves. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with celebrated children's writer Lois Lowry, author of the young adult now classic, The Giver. Her latest and last in that series, Sun, is out next week. She's in the studio with me right here. Cynthia writes to us, Lois, she says, I'm enjoying this discussion. She says, I've enjoyed The Giver again and again, gathering blue alongside my children. Cynthia writes, I assume I would be a breeder, one of your birth mothers, as the mother of five who loved being pregnant but felt like my brain would be wasted. I love this concept. Thrilled to read the next book. So everybody's relating their own personal experience. Let's get a call from San Francisco. David is calling. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Lois, it's great to be on with you.
I actually used to work
at Random House Children's Books, and The Giver was one of the books that I worked on a constant basis. And the thing about that, my job there was I was exposed to and had to read the entire gamut of books for kids that age, YA and the like. And so I saw everything from, you know, sticker books all the way up to the most philosophical, heady books for kids that age. And I think it's so important for a book like The Giver to be, you know, required reading. Part of the reason because kids that age are first starting to really wake up in the world, and they're starting to question the world around them. Who is it? Or who am I? What does it mean to be a person in society?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to be good and just? And who is the authority presiding over me? And should I question them or challenge them? And so that's the prime age for kids to start really, you know, asking themselves these sort of deep, heady questions about the world around them and their role in it.
But David, there you were as a publisher. Weren't there lots of young adult books who were raising these themes? Was there something except The Giver apart in that arena?
There were lots of books like that. The Giver had a popularity, though, that meant that it was read by a lot more. It was constantly on, you know, nationwide reading lists.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it did stand above a lot of others in terms of its kids' access to it. I just wish there were more books like it that kids would read.
You know what, Dave? Your comments have answered a question that I'm often asked, which is, do you intend to write for adults as if that's a natural progression? And my answer is that early on, I was a writer for both adults and kids. And way back, as they would say in The Giver, I began to realize how important books can be to kids the age of the readers of The Giver, 12, 13, 14. That's an age at which kids are affected by a book and often changed by a book. And I know that still from the mail I get from kids every day, email now. They tell me how their view of the world has been changed by what they've read. That doesn't happen any longer, I think, to adults. I read a lot. I read books for adults. I am not any longer going to be changed by those books.
So maybe more influence at the age you've targeted.
It's an important age, and it's an important age to write for. It's important that there be good books for that age.
David, I appreciate your call from San Francisco. Boy, karma is very real here. David works on your book way back then at Random House. He's on the phone with you today. Thank you, David. Sean in Versailles, Kentucky. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Big fan of the show and the author.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. What's on your mind?
These days, we're drowning in these dystopian works. But when I was a kid, outside of science fiction, you know, I had to embrace the classics for the dystopian, you know, genre, I guess, Orwell and Huxley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if the author was inspired or influenced by any specific works or or the whole dystopian genre, or if it came together more organically.
1984, Brave New World.
I went to college in the 50s. At age 17, I went to Brown to study writing. And I read in English courses at that time Brave New World, probably read Orwell then as well. But it had been a number of years before I wrote The Giver. And so I wasn't consciously aware of that history in my reading, but certainly it was there subconsciously. It arose, I think, as Tom just said, more organically from circumstances in the world and in my own life at that time. I was never, incidentally, a reader or a liker of so-called science fiction. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this book has been called that, although I would take issue with that description.
We've got questions here online. Greg wants to know if Plato's Republic influenced your writing of The Giver. And he also says, politically, The Giver has a lot in common with the works of Ayn Rand. The world is controlled, and one hero has to break free from authority to be human.
I have been asked that question about Plato before, and I'm always embarrassed to answer it because I'm a reasonably well-educated person, but I have never read Plato's Republic.
Oh,
so,
well, that answers
sorry
the question, but
that.
maybe high time.
And I've also been asked, and including by one of my own grandsons, about Rand's book Anthem, which seems to have some similarities to The Giver. I have never read Anthem. So I can't actually say that I was influenced by either of those, but they're out there in the atmosphere, and perhaps subconsciously I've been without even reading them.
Quite vivid in the atmosphere sometimes in this year when Paul Ryan, the Republican VP candidate, mm-hmm. has championed Ayn Rand and read a lot of it. And part of the sort of dialectic around this election season has been Republicans saying Barack Obama is building a world where it's controlled. And, you know, you heard Mitt Romney on this sort of infamous bootleg tape saying 47% want to, you know, they're victims. Yeah. They're on the government kind of dole. It's his. I don't know. How does all that very current political debate factor into the way you see?
Teachers appreciate having a book like The Giver, which can lead into a political discussion among kids about political issues without a teacher having to take a stance, nor do I. Okay, I voted for Obama, I confess. I'm a Democrat. But I didn't intend the book to have a political viewpoint. But certainly there are political issues raised. And also, people have found religious themes to the book The Giver and to, in particular, the book Messenger. And they're used in a lot of religious curricula across the country. I didn't intend for that to be there. And I always reply to people who write and ask if there's Christian theology in the book, that it's there for them if they find it there. But I don't want to say it's there to the detriment of all the Jewish people who give it as a bar mitzvah gift, seeing it as a rite of passage, boy becoming man and taking on responsibilities.
We've just got a couple of minutes left, Lois. Do you see us in a world where people are moving away from passion, love, agency, free will, or has there been a shift overall around your book in these years?
I'm hardly a person in a position to make broad, sweeping statements like that.
The Giver, we made demure.
I would hope that we're not, that deep feelings like passion and love will never cease to exist in our world and to affect the way we make decisions.
And the current generation of readers, if they're 12 years old, do they seem changed from those 20 years ago, or is it still the same big questions?
I think readers now still are affected by the same things, still wonder about the same things, but they want books that move along more quickly than books that readers some years ago were able to deal with more introspective, quieter, slower-paced books.
So if this is your last in the Giver series, does it mean in your what comes next? We're going to be climbing even taller cliffs and riding spaceships?
Something will come next. I don't yet know what it will be.
You still have the enthusiasm for writing, we hope.
Oh, I sure do. Yeah, it's the thing I love most in the world. I'm so lucky to be able to have a job that I love doing, as you do, I suppose.
Well, this is true. It's nice to engage with people and engage with ideas and engage with the world we live in. You've done all of those in these books. It's amazing to look at all these comments coming in and people's calls, how strongly influence is after so many years. That's got to be a good feeling.
It is. It's a great feeling. Yeah.
Maybe, as you say, maybe a reason to be a young adult writer when you can still get into the software and have a little effect on it.
Yeah.
Lois Lowry, author of The Giver, the series that followed. The last of them comes out next week. It is Sun. She's joined us today in the studio. Lois Lowry, it's been wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a privilege and a pleasure.
In a moment, we'll look at writer J.K. Rowling's first book out since the Harry Potter series. This is On Point. Harry Potter creator J.K. Rowling is out with her first book since wrapping up the Potter world of wizardry and Hogwarts. It's a thoroughly adult book called The Casual Vacancy. Some critics have loved it, some have not. Time magazine book critic Lev Grossman joins us to look at where Rowling has gone post-Harry Potter. Lev Grossman, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, so there's thumbs up and thumbs down. You were a big Harry Potter fan. Your thumbs up for this whole new version of J.K. Rowling.
Well, I am, and I wasn't sure that I would be necessarily. It's very rare for a writer of young adult fiction to be able to make the leap to literary fiction aimed at adults. Roald Dahl, of course, tried for many years and never really broke through. So I didn't know what to expect from Rowling, and I was more than pleasantly surprised. I thought this was a masterful novel.
So give us the setting for this new book, The Casual Vacancy. What's the outline of the story, Lev?
Well, it's not a sort of home run of a pitch. A small town in England called Pagford. There's a low-income housing development in the town, on the edge of town, and the parish council is fighting over that development. They want to sort of transfer ownership of it to their neighboring town because they're tired of the sort of petty crime and expenses, educating the kids, running a rehab center. They're tired of the expense and sort of tawdriness of
the riffraff
housing. The riffraff, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so they're pushing. I mean, it hardly sounds like a barn burner, and yet, I mean, you're saying this. You wrote in Time magazine, this is a great novel. What makes it so, in your view?
Well, the plot's – that pitch, the plot, is a bit of a red herring. Mm-hmm. What it's about is it's about the people. It's about the people on the council. It's about their marriages. It's about their relationships to their children. It's about their hopes for their lives that have both been fulfilled and not been fulfilled. There's just a world of longing, of suffering, of love and anger just below the surface of this town. And that is what Rowling takes us into. And it's extraordinary what she does with it.
Here's J.K. Rowling. What is she, 47 now, worth reportedly $900 million. She's got mansions all over the place in Scotland and country places and you name it. What do you feel when you read this new book, The Casual Vacancy? What do you feel driving her?
Well, it's funny. Rowling is tremendously ambitious, and that's my read on her anyway, only having met her once. Mm-hmm. This is a woman who never gave up her dreams of writing, even when she had to go in the dole, was a single mother. She still kept at it. And I would be surprised if somebody like that, just because they got $1 billion, would be able to sort of turn off that wheel that pushes them forward, that makes them want to do more. There was a lot of work that went into this novel. It is very well crafted. And you can see that she wasn't satisfied with Harry Potter, and maybe she'll never be satisfied.
I've got just a little tape of J.K. Rowling talking yesterday with NPR's Steve Inskeep about the genesis of the new book, The Casual Vacancy.
I just needed to write this book. It was an idea that came to me in 2007. I had the idea actually in the States. I was on tour promoting the last in the Potter series, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and I was on a plane and had the idea for The Casual Vacancy. And exactly as had happened with Harry Potter, I knew it was something I really, really wanted to write. I became excited about the idea of writing it. It's a very personal book in a lot of ways. It's not a memoir. I'm not in the book. It's not my story. But it does address themes, subjects that are very important to me. And so that was the starting point.
J.K. Rowling with NPR's Steve Inskeep there on her latest, The Casual Vacancy. Lev Grossman is with us from Time magazine. He says it's a big, ambitious, brilliant, profane, funny, deeply upsetting, magnificently eloquent novel of contemporary England, rich with literary intelligence and entirely bereft of BS. okay, that is one great list. Can you still hear the cadence, the author of Harry Potter in the prose here, Lev?
Short answer, no. I would not have recognized this as a book by J.K. Rowling if it had been presented to me blind. She has re-engineered the way that she writes, her prose style. She has upgraded it, I guess you could say. It's not the sort of simple, direct, slightly too many adverbs style that she used in Harry Potter. It is a very, as I said before, eloquent, beautifully crafted, quite funny, but very verbally alive kind of writing. And it's not a voice I'd heard from her before.
You wrote you expected a kind of aged up, magicked down Harry Potter. And I guess this surprised you on the upside there. What's at the heart of what she's exploring here? Where she wants to take us with this one, Lev?
She wants to look, I think, at the way that good and evil live inside of everybody. When you look at the characters in this book and this, you know, a dozen or more main characters, you see each of them acting, doing bad things and good things. Each one of them is a hero, each one of them is a villain, and nobody is that simple. You saw this, actually, in Harry Potter. You saw it with figures like Snape or maybe Draco Malfoy, who had moments of good and moments of evil. Here, it's a world of Snapes in the Casual Vacancy, and she really gets at the complexity and strangeness of the human soul.
Do you think adult readers who liked Harry Potter, you were one of them, are going to like this? You do, but you say this one's a painfully arbitrary and fallen world, she describes, a world bereft of the magic that animates and ennobles Hogwarts. If people come to this looking for that, are they going to be left blue?
I was enthralled by this book. I picked it up and it would not let me go. I would be surprised if people sort of who grew up reading Harry Potter, I would be surprised if they were sort of not ready for this. It's a harsh book, but a very sort of human book, very funny book. I would be surprised if people were not drawn in.
You wrote, it's as if Rowling were an animagus, except that instead of turning into a stag or a dog or whatever, she transformed into Ian McEwan. Do we have that rarest of appearances here, the young adult writer who comes out and is fully there in the world of literature for adults?
I recognize that I'm an outlier on this issue. The other reviews of the book have not been that kind, but I feel like if this book did not have J.K. Rowling's name on it, it would be a Booker Prize book, it would be a critically esteemed book, it would be a significant addition to the canon of novels in English.
Well, Lev Grossman reports, you decide. I guess many people will. Lev, book critic for Time Magazine, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you very much for your report today on J.K. Rowling and The Casual Vacancy. Thanks a lot for joining us, Lev.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.